Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, when I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way to New Orleans.
That was Janis Joplin. I'm Richard Roth, and this is The Passage. Bono said we watch a movie but live in a song or something like that, and that was one of the songs we lived in 1971, which is the year that my guest today, Alexandra, or Allie Anderson Spivey, became Arts and Centerfold Editor at The Village Voice. She's been coming to Hudson almost since then, and so she's watched it change dramatically, and she has some advice on how to make it stay great. So stay tuned. after the interview, a guitar piece, Variations on a Theme of Tárrega by Agustín Barrios, South American composer, played by the Dutch guitarist Enno Verhorst. My guest is Alexandra Anderson Spivey, who has a long career in publishing in New York. She was executive editor for Smart Magazine, an American Photographer, editor-in-chief for Art and Antiques, a senior editor for Portfolio, art editor for the Paris Review, arts and centerfold editor for the Village Voice, and an associate editor at the New York Arts Review and the New York Review of Books. She's currently working on a book about Baron Adolf de Meyer. Why don't we start there, Allie?
Sure. Okay. I'd love to. Well, I guess I could say something about the Baron de Meyer first. The Baron de Meyer is a rather forgotten figure in photography, although at the time of his most prolific work, he was probably the most famous photographer in terms of the fact that he invented fashion photography.
Now, when would that have been?
He was born in 1868 in Paris. He died in Hollywood in 1946. He was he became a very famous pictorialist amateur photographer in London between around 1894 and 1912. He had married the goddaughter of Edward VII, and she was an extraordinary figure called Olga Caracciolo, and she came from a long line of femme fatale. In fact, her great-grandmother brought down Andrew Jackson's first cabinet, and that's another story.
Sounds like a very interesting story.
Very interesting. And de Meyer actually came to America in 1912 and was hired in 1913 by Condé Nast to be the first on-staff fashion photographer for Vogue, and then very rapidly for Vanity Fair, which was just being started by Frank Crowninshield, the great editor Frank Crowninshield. De Meyer took many, many pictures which people know of, but they don't know that it was him. The most famous ones that most people have seen were his suite on Ballet Russe and Nijinsky, which he took in London in 1912.
Now, those are some of the famous photos of Nijinsky.
Nijinsky as an après-midi d'une femme.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but now why was de Meyer forgotten when he was so famous? Because he worked for Vogue and Vanity Fair between 1913 and 1921. He was hired away in 1921 by Hearst, and he went back to Paris because basically he was European, and became the chief photographer and correspondent for Harper's Bazaar, a job he kept until 1934 when Carmel Snow, the new editor, pitched him out because he was old-fashioned. Remember, he's basically an Edwardian figure. At this point, he could not work for Vogue because the editor of Vogue, Edna Wilman Chase, was still in power, and she was still angry with him for defecting to the rival Harper's Bazaar. His wife had died. It was a depression, and he was desperate for work. He did ask her if he could come back to Vogue. She said no. He could no longer work for Harper's Bazaar because he'd been his contract had not been renewed. So he ends up in Hollywood, where he thinks he will be able to take pictures of the actresses who he knew in the 1920s as stage actresses. And they were often his models for the fashion shoots. However, since no magazines would publish this work, the two prominent ones wouldn't publish it, he really rapidly descended into obscurity. There's a lot more to this story, since he had adopted a handsome Austrian mechanic who he brought to Hollywood with him, but you'll have to read the book to find out about that. The sad thing is that his style was superseded by Steichen, and then by Munkazi, and then by Avedon, and he basically dies forgotten in 1946.
In the 1930s, were Vogue and Harper's Bazaar, I suppose they were as elegant and chic as always.
Even
right?
more, oh yes, they were. Yes, they were through the Depression. They were, and the Baron de Meyer has often either been overlooked or misidentified. He was criticized for being a phony baron. He is a real baron. He's a German baron. Basically, his work was sidelined because it was kind of a casualty of modernism and also a casualty of the fact that he had no heirs to protect his reputation. So it's actually a fascinating story, and it's also a story about the development of glamour and ideas of fashion between 1913 and 1940.
What drew your interest, the work itself?
Because he was, when I went to do a small project on him, I found that the information was extremely faulty and that his reputation was being unfairly maligned. And the curators of photography were not interested in correcting the record. I believe Sotheby's still has his death date wrong, no matter how long we tell them it's wrong. So very sloppy knowledge about him. And I thought, well, this is an amazing story. And there's a lot more to the story because he was extremely highly socially placed. And he had quite a fascinating life meeting everyone. And I just thought it was time to set the record straight on the Baron de Meyer. Sadly, because he is so unknown, this is a difficult book to sell in the climate of publishing today. But we will sell it, and it will probably be a lavishly illustrated photo book.
Now, are there prints available?
Yes, they come up at auction quite often. The market is very... some things come up very high. I'd say the range goes between $25,000 and hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on the images. The Met has a pretty good collection of his work given to them by Stieglitz, who was actually the Baron de Meyer's dealer at 291. But the work is very scattered, and sadly, de Meyer did burn up a lot of his work in despair in Paris in 1934 when he was dismissed from Harper's Bazaar. So the work is widely dispersed.
As far as the negatives, are they around?
There are some, not really. I think I think that may be what he destroyed. And also, in terms of the prints, a lot of them went to the magazines. And for example, the Harper's Bazaar archive was lost in the 60s when Harper's Bazaar in Paris moved its offices, and someone left the boxes of prints on the sidewalk, and they disappeared. So this often happened when work that was done for magazines was really not respected as what we would call fine art today. So a lot of times art directors took stuff home or they threw it out, and de Meyer's art prints appeared quite frequently in camera work. They do come up on the market, but it's very catch-as-catch-can. So we'll see. He's a fascinating figure, and as I say, his glamorous wife, Olga, was even more fascinating. Olga had a notorious affair with Winnaretta Singer, the great musical patron, who was the Princess de Polignac, who was one of Diaghilev's major supporters in terms of commissioning music for the Ballet Russe. So it was a small circle. But Olga was very beautiful and very wild. And nevertheless, the Baron loved her. As we say, they were social acrobats at the highest level. So I'm hoping to finish this and get this record set straight. That's the whole reason for doing it.
How long have you been working on the...
Too long, maybe 6 years, off and on, but I've done a lot of other stuff in between.
And you have some other books in your resume here, Keith Haring for one.
I wrote a little book on the last works of Keith Haring, and I wrote a big book on an artist called Robert Kushner, who I think is a very fine artist. And I still do a lot of writing for ArtNet online. That's my main gig at the moment. Although I do write catalogs and essays for other places. And I'm basically art historian and cultural critic.
Now, I've read a number of your reviews on ArtNet. Do you choose your subject?
Yes. That is one of the great advantages of working for ArtNet. The writers have a lot of latitude about what we want to do, which is very refreshing. The editor, Walter Robinson, is a brilliant, brilliant editor.
Walter Robinson was in East Village.
Absolutely, yeah. He was a painter, and he worked at art in America for a long time, and he's probably the best editor around in the field. Not in the least because he trusts his writers.
Well, it's great to have a great editor.
Yeah, they're rare. In fact, the only other great one I ever had was at the Village Voice.
Now, how long were you at the Voice?
Oh, it's so long. Let's see. I was there 4 years, 3 years, 4 years. Kind of blur, as you know. Those were the days when they delivered the drugs to your desk, so you kind of couldn't remember a lot of things.
It must have been a pretty exciting, fun time.
It was a great job. It was a great job.
Was Jill Johnston there during?
She was there in the beginning. Yeah, she was there, and it was a time when the Voice was undergoing some turmoil because Dan Wolf and Ed Fancher, the founders, were in the process of first selling it to Carter Burden and Bartle Bull, and then the Bartle Bull and Carter Burden sold it to Clay Felker, who then made a kind of hellish partnership with Rupert Murdoch. And when I left, Rupert Murdoch had sort of taken it over. And somewhere in there, then it was sold to this guy, Leonard Fleischman, the Birdseed King. Anyway, the Voice was changing hands and changing. But Clay Felker changed it very much when he brought in an entire new layer of editors and art directors. When I worked there in the beginning, there was a copy editor. There was I don't even know if there was an art director. It just sort of got pasted down, and if your article didn't fit, it got chopped off at the bottom.
That's right.
To put the good stuff at the top. It really did just cut off like that.
Right. That was how it was done. It was pasted together.
Column inches. You had to make your mock-ups. We did it all without computers, guys. It was pretty amazing to do a weekly. I don't know if anybody could do that today. They wouldn't know how.
And then from there you went to Vogue.
I did.
And that must have been a fairly radical.
That was culture shock. I was a renegade of Vogue. I was very counterculture at Vogue. I lasted at Vogue about 2.5 years. It was overcrowded with very talented editorial people, which was a Cy Newhouse technique to warehouse the talent. So again, Hearst didn't get it, but that would mean there were too many people fighting over writing a caption. It was literally a very interesting strategy, but very hard on the people who worked for the different publications, because it was sort of like an overcrowded mental apartment building. I think I was trying to write columns for Vogue about women in the environment, and they kept reminding me it was a fantasy magazine. It was not a place for incendiary political articles. So I ended up again writing a lot about different artists. I actually quit Vogue to go and start something called the Ear Inn, which was a bar down on Spring Street. And I told Alex Lieberman I was quitting to become a waitress. He was very confused. He said, "Don't you want to work on House and Garden?" I said, "No, I'm going to become a waitress."
Now, the Ear Inn, that was on Spring Street.
Spring Street, over near the docks, and it had been a big longshoreman's bar for a long time. And we turned it into an artist bar. And a lot of the Fluxus artists used to go there, like George Matunis and Jeffrey Hendricks and Dick Higgins. And it was pretty interesting. It was great. And then we started a magazine called Portfolio, which was another art magazine.
Which was another very beautifully produced magazine.
Yeah, a much more general art magazine. And then I helped start something called Art and Auction, but that was kind of on the side. That was a time when you could do these independent magazines, which, as we know, have been superseded by conglomerates and then also by the Internet. So that was just a very brief moment when you could. It was more of an old-fashioned, let's start a magazine moment. But
Do you find any difference between writing for the Internet as compared to writing for print?
It's shorter. On the Internet, you have to write shorter. Nobody's going to read 2,500 words. And I'm probably a dinosaur. I don't do blogs. I don't believe in writing for no money. Like Samuel Johnson said, a man who writes for no money is a fool. I think it's much more about the editor than about the venue, about how you write. And, of course, for the Internet, you want to write in a very accessible way. You want to not be bogged down in jargon or academic theory. You'll lose your readers. And I think you can be much more spontaneous on the Internet. And also the other great difference is you can write about something while it's happening, so that if someone chances to read what you've done, they still have the opportunity to run out and see what it was you were talking about. Whereas in periodicals, unless it's a daily newspaper or a weekly, by the time the article comes out, the exhibition is probably long gone.
When did you first come up to this area?
I first came here to visit Edward Abadesian and John Ashbery, who were friends of mine, and they are probably responsible for me being here. And they had come in the middle 70s, I believe, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think John Ashbery came in 1976 or something. And so coming up to see them one day with a friend, we drove around and looked at real estate. And we saw a house. And we said, wow, that's the house. That's an amazing house. And knowing little or nothing, we bought it on the spot. And but we did know that we very much liked the Hudson Valley. I knew I had been involved a lot with Olana in the beginning, getting Olana saved. And I found the whole Hudson River very, very compelling. So it was an area that I liked, but I would say it was rather an innocent arrival. And then, of course, in the past few years, everything has changed enormously, and Hudson has become a much more dynamic and creative location than it was 20, 25 years ago, when it was kind of still for thrall to very old-fashioned politics and an old-fashioned attitude about manufacturing. And it had sort of gone to sleep, I would say, right? At least certainly John Ashbery would have said that, which is what he told me. So that's when I came, and it's been very interesting to watch the area go through all these different permutations. And in a strange way, it's still not very well known, which is kind of wonderful and curious. I actually vowed when I got here that I would never write an article for New York Magazine about Columbia County, because I didn't want anybody to know about it. I wanted it to be a little secret.
Well, now Marina Abramovic is saying she's going to put it on the map.
Well, and I think Marina may have, at least briefly, already put it on the map if she does manage and succeed to create her performance arts center. It should be a kind of amazing magnet. Although I do wonder how many people are going to go to 6 or 8 hour performances. Perhaps there are more of them than I know.
Well, you heard about the chairs are going to have little beds that you can turn around on, and if you fall asleep, a docent will take you.
We'll spray
out to the take you to the side room until you wake up.
Oh, kind of like a big airplane. I mean, okay. Well, and that may be good for maybe kind of a spa-like experience then.
Right.
But anyway, I think her ambition is remarkable. And it'll be very interesting to see if it comes to pass. But in the meantime, certainly Hudson and the surrounding towns have become magnets for extremely creative people, not only artists and writers, but a remarkable number of actually rather famous art historians and scholars. We have Edward Sullivan, who's here, and he is, as you know, the dean. He was the dean of humanities at NYU, and he's the greatest expert on Latin American art. We have a whole bunch of them. We also have a lot of art dealers, like I think Matthew Marks has a place. I know Alan Wingate has a place. He's a highly, I believe, second in command at Gagosian. We have many amazing architects who live in the surrounding towns of Hudson. And, of course, we have all of the writers and artists who have gravitated to Hudson. We were talking about Joe Pozzi, who's been here. We were talking also, of course, we have Ellsworth Kelly in Spencertown. We have the great Richard Archwager. Probably the most elegant artist, sartorially, that you can imagine. We have, over in Catskill, we have Kiki Smith. We have Bryce Martin, who's down near Tivoli. And we have, of course, many, many, with Bill Sullivan. A lot of these are what would we call them, I don't want to say escapees from New York, because they certainly keep their connection to the city, but they have kind of replicated a Soho ambiance in a small Hudson River town, which is extremely interesting. Gerald Belanga is here.
Lucio says that it kind of reminds him of Soho in the 60s.
I think it's true because of the sense of community. And as someone said, if there are problems with Hudson, it's certainly not the architecture. So people who are visually sensitive really gravitate toward these beautiful houses. And thank goodness they have the knowledge and the will to fix them up. The other thing that's happening, I think, interestingly enough, is the attendant explosion of restaurants and interest in local food, which kind of is another part of the creative community. And then you have this burgeoning music scene, which is bringing a lot of people to Hudson. I think there are many writers. Again, they tend to be rather less visible, but they're here. And the infrastructure is creating galleries and facilities like the Basilica, which are extremely attractive to all of this creative capital. We have TSL, which came very early. We have Stage Works. Look at all, I mean, it's kind of amazing, actually, all of the enterprises that have sprung up. I think there needs to be much better critical or journalistic coverage of all these activities in the local papers. I think the papers are doing their readers a disservice not to be more attentive to this very vibrant scene that is kind of percolating around everywhere. They seem to print press releases. They don't have any critical distance on what's going on. Would you agree?
I would agree, and part of the problem, I think, is just that print media is having such a problem, and they can't afford to pay writers.
Well, of course, as an art critic, they could never afford to pay us. So that was, I mean, that's nothing new. It was always Grub Street. And the, actually, the Internet has even put more pressure on that because they always think you'll write for free. And that is, there's a struggle going on about that now. People are saying, well, you know, how long can we write for free until we starve to death? So that eventually content will have to be paid for one way or another. But maybe what should happen is some kind of a full court press should be put on the newspapers. And even if they won't pay us a lot, maybe we can storm the barricades and get some better copy into them, because frankly they're pretty boring.
Well, it certainly would be the Register has a weekend supplement, and it would be you know, a possible having the thing exists already,
it right, but they have don't the have it's just basically listings, isn't it?
That's
yeah,
right, yeah,
there's
yeah.
no there's no feisty commentary or interviews. Or I think one could do a great long-lived column just on the creative personalities who are often recalcitrant. In many ways, they come up here so that they won't be discovered or won't be bothered. But you could do a very interesting series on who they are that would be outside of just reviewing gallery shows, for example, or presentations at the Opera House. You would go and find the people ask them why they're here. It'd be quite interesting.
No, I did a few of those in the with the Independent.
And how did they go? Were they good?
Yeah, well, yeah, people enjoyed them, I think. Rodney Greenblatt and Lucio.
There you go,
Richard
Rodney. And Minsky. Richard Minsky, the great book artist, is here and has this most amazing mini museum in his own house end of the 19th century, early 20th century book cover. Books with embossed covers, right? You've seen it.
Oh,
it's
I've
amazing.
Seen it in the Barnes & Noble did a calendar
this year.
Did
a calendar based
on
it,
yes.
Yeah. It's just very interesting to see what's going on slightly beneath the surface. Performance art. The galleries, I don't quite understand the galleries, but it may be what is economically viable. I think it's a characteristic of regional art, if you will, that, you know, the audience that is going to buy the pictures is, you know, they have a certain level they're not going to go beyond in terms of price. And the other thing, of course, we haven't talked about is that we have all the decorative arts. I mean, we have Mark McDonald, who is the greatest dealer in mid-century modern furniture, certainly one of the greatest dealers in the country. We have hugely knowledgeable antiques dealers. We have the great eye of Tim Dunleavy, who is in his own way a kind of a curator in his store, Rural Residences, which is beautiful. We have Tom Swope, who is a great expert in antiquities. His gallery is actually first rate. And then we have the wonderful guy who has the great frames. So you have this layer that is not only contemporary, but delving back into the past. Be very interesting to maybe put some of the artists and the antique dealers together for a conversation. And the antique dealers came the same reason the artists came: cheap rents. You know, artists and artists are the earthworms of real estate.
First it was, I guess it kind of always is, first it was the artists, though, right? I mean, first it was Avedisian,
yes,
and
yes,
Ashbery.
Yes. And a few others who I kind of remember back when. Yes. But the storefronts and the setup, just as it had happened in this little town of Cold Spring, were magnets for for shopkeepers because the infrastructure was there.
And particularly antique dealers because the buildings themselves were so
they suited,
attractive.
Right. And I think Alain was one of the first ones, wasn't he?
I believe so.
Yeah, yeah. And Alphonse. So we actually have this very interesting minestrone, if you will, of all of these creative minds and capabilities. Oh, and we mustn't forget what when Sotheby's had the restoration studio, which Stair took over, that brought into the community really remarkable artisans who could do everything. They could do gilding. They could do veneers. They could restore anything. Many of them are still in the area, and Stair took over that facility. And of course, Stair is another anchor, a very interesting anchor, and provider of jobs, which is excellent. The only thing, I think it would be great if Hudson could strengthen its commitment to historic preservation. In the long run, it would serve the city very well, since the architectural heritage of Hudson is really quite unique, and really it is part of the creative capital that will make the city stand out from other places which have destroyed so much. And as we know, an interesting thing is the internet is disintermediating even some of the big box stores, which, you know, luckily they're all out on Fairview Avenue, so they don't intrude on the city proper. But I think, what would we call it? Unique retail experience is something people will like as more and more they can buy the Walmart stuff and over the internet. They know what it is. They don't have to come and look at it. So I wonder if that's not going to have an effect down the road that would be good for places like Hudson, because they will be they will provide a much richer actual experience instead of virtual experience. And of course, they're always, if the restaurants are good, everybody will come, right? It's food. Everybody loves food. And what I also think the beauty of Columbia County is a great solace and inspiration to many of the artists who are here. And that is also a prime reason why they come. We do have the founding of the Hudson River School right here between Thomas Cole and Frederick Church, and then we have the great Sanford Gifford, and who, as we know, is buried in the Hudson graveyard. And I believe there is a big push to restore his grave. And then we even have, 19th century painting dealers like Peter Young, who does a good job. So we really have a very eclectic scene going on.
It's quite amazing in the town this size to have so much.
It is. And the Opera House. We should mention the Opera House. We should also mention the Columbia County Historical Society, which is about to open an exhibit in April on the Civil War in Columbia County. And this has been put together by the Society's extraordinary curator, who's called Diane Sawchuk. You should have her on your program.
I have had her on my program.
She's great, right?
She's great.
And this exhibit is open to everybody, and it really will be very, very interesting. So, again, that is a museum experience that we have. We also have the great Fireman's Museum, which is very undersold. It's amazing how many people have never been there. And we have Olana.
And we have Claremont.
Claremont. And we have all the houses, the Vanderpool House.
And there's the Daughters of the American Revolution.
The DAR, which is remarkable. And then we have the Plum Bronson House, which is one of the great houses in America. And someday, soon, it will be more open to the public. So I guess the only thing we don't really have is a super-duper hotel.
And that is another...
there are rumors.
Rumors that Marina also wants to... take over the St. Charles Hotel.
Well, somebody should take over the St. Charles Hotel because it's a sleeping beauty, if you will. I just think that you have to look a little under the surface in Columbia County to find out how much vitality is really there. There's a very unique, eclectic mix of activities and people which you do not find in more socially stratified communities around New York.
Is there anything else we should talk about, Allie?
Well, Richard, what do you think? You tell me. The river. We should talk about the river, how to use the river better. That's the sort of way out of my league, but it does occur to me all the time.
I think it hasn't been that long since you could take a boat from New York to Albany.
That's right, and now you can take one only to Bear Mountain, I think. And then once in a while, there'll be special, like the National Trust will do a weekend coming up the Hudson. But the river is definitely an underutilized resource, no doubt about it.
This is, of course, on the minds of a lot of people in Hudson to make sure that the riverfront is not overrun with too much industry.
Right, isn't too enthralled to industry. And that is a monumental struggle. I will be interested to see, how that all turns out. So there's preservation of the architectural infrastructure, more creative use of the river, more dialogue about all of the creative activities that are going on. So there's some, I would say, some judgment about. And the awful thing is, often with regional art, everybody's very kind. It's hard to say that the pictures of your next-door neighbor are perfectly nice, but maybe they aren't really much more than very nice. This is the critic talking. And, it's awfully hard in a small place to establish what the critical parameters should be. It can't just be boosterism. But it takes all layers. It's just important to identify them truthfully and not fall into the trap of mindless boosterism, I would say. And that, I don't mean to be unkind, but I think the way you improve things is to have free and frank discussion about their value. On the other artists we have here, which we haven't seen enough of, is probably David Deutsch.
We don't see much of anything of his work.
Well, he exhibits very infrequently, and then over in Ghent is also William Wegman. We know that. So I think I will close with my favorite Taconic sighting of an artist. Was coming up the Taconic at the rest stop, is it Pleasant Valley or wherever it is, the one where everybody stops on the road to Poughkeepsie there.
Right.
And I look at the picnic table, which has a large plastic, like a Dairy Queen cone on the middle of the table as an ornament. And there I see Ellsworth Kelly eating his sandwich. And I think to myself, this is so great. Nobody at this rest stop has any idea of who that guy is. He's having a great time, and he's just being left alone. And maybe that's another virtue of Columbia County for artists and writers, which is people can, they don't get mobbed by adoring fans because they can remain relatively anonymous.
Thank you very much for coming.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
Thank you.